morning. I'm Joanne Stefanik. This morning on Maritime Magazine, the Chinese community. The Chinese once called Canada Golden Mountain. It's proven so golden, in fact, that the Chinese now make up the fastest growing immigrant group in the country. But at one point in our history, we taxed them if they wanted to migrate to Canada. And later, in a racist act of parliament, we wouldn't allow them to come in, period. The Chinese first came to the Maritimes around 1890, more than 30 years after establishing themselves in BC. Out of work after the completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1885, many Chinese railway workers headed east. Despite obstacles, the Chinese have had a major impact on provinces such as BC and Ontario. Stories of success and struggle which are widely known. A new exhibit at the Nova Scotia Museum in Halifax reveals the little-known story of the Chinese community in Halifax, a story that played itself out in other maritime cities such as St. John or Fredericton as well. The Halifax experience is told largely through photographs assembled by photojournalist Albert Lee. Recently, Jennifer Henderson toured the display with Albert Lee and gives us this snapshot of the Chinese community.
The whole show itself involves four families that were originally here. I started with the Lins, the Lees, the Fawns, the Hums, their original families. Maybe perhaps we could just proceed on up the gallery area.
The first Lee came to Halifax from Hoi Ping in 1903. A formal portrait of Albert's Chinese grandfather and his father at age 9 shows them dressed in suits and sitting stiffly in high-backed Victorian chairs in a Barrington Street portrait studio. In order to get into Canada, Chinese immigrants needed sponsors. The Fong sponsored Chuck Lee, who worked long days at the San Juan Laundry, to repay the price of his admission into Canada, a $50 head tax that Ottawa later raised to $500 to discourage Asian immigration. Albert Lee.
Between 1923 and 1947, there was a Chinese Exclusion Act, which is enacted by the federal government, which restricted the movement of Chinese to Canada. So a lot of the men in particular in Halifax, whose bar, like the Chinese community up until 1950, was primarily men with a sprinkling of women because women were not allowed here in Canada.
Only 7 Chinese legally entered Canada during this period. Professor James Walker of the University of Waterloo spoke in Halifax recently. He says the law simply confirmed the ignorant suspicions of Canadians struggling through tough economic times.
The law gave public effect to people's private beliefs and fears about race, and in doing so, both confirmed and extended them. It goes like this, according to Mackenzie King. Anyway, the baser metal tends to drive the finer metal out of circulation. The same thing would happen, Mackenzie King told House of Commons, if lower races were allowed to mingle freely in Canada. Anglo-Saxons would be debased.
It was during this time that Albert's father returned to China to marry and to father a child. He came back to Canada, but the Exclusion Act meant Chuck Lee would have to wait 17 years before he could sponsor and finally meet his daughter, Nancy. In the meantime, he sent pictures of himself back to China.
Here's different immigration photographs, and there's a couple of nice vacays too of my parents. Starting with when my mother was first in China and my father was here, there's a photograph that's like that at the end, where the person who was living overseas was always photographed in the studio here, and then they mailed a picture back over to China to be copied onto another studio portrait over there. So it goes straight like this whole chain with computers is nothing new.
Taking photographs to create an illusion of family life was the only way many Chinese could be together. Decades of separation that created siblings who were strangers to one another was just one result of the Exclusion Act. In Albert Lee's case, his mother began a second family when she arrived in Canada.
Kind of father, so it must be their grandfather.
offended the Lees and someone who also had two families, one in China and one in Canada. An extremely frugal man, Hum made his clothes from salesman samples he stitched together himself. His Mayfair Cafe on Cottage Street was a long way from home.
Hum Wing Ho arrived in Vancouver by steamship and made his way to St. John in Brunswick by train in 1922. He had gone there to work in a cousin's small Chinese dam lodge. There, he toiled 16 and 18 hours a day to repay his steamship and rail fares, as well as his tax, and most importantly, to send money home. Life was harsh in China, and people suffered extreme poverty and hardship. He was chosen by his father as a young boy to help the family in China and work in the faraway Golden Mountain, which is what the Chinese government called Canada.
Racism was a daily fact of life for many Chinese maritimers like Chuck Lee, who refused to take the name Charlie that whites called most Chinese men. Chuck graduated from a Nova Scotia university with an engineering degree in 1939, but he couldn't find anyone to hire him. Racism also stung Mary Ling, then an 8-year-old schoolgirl growing up on her parents' farm in Africville.
I was very lonely, to be honest, because my parents were very protective. For one thing, we were only allowed to speak Chinese at home, so we didn't mingle with the other children at all until I went to school. It was happy in that the older girls and some of my classmates and teachers were very good to me. I was like a little novelty, and they used to play with me and fix me up. But then I also have a bad experience that I can never erase. This little girl took me home, and we were very good friends at school. But then when she took me home, the mother slammed the door in my face. So next day, she still wanted to play with me, but she couldn't. So I asked her why, and she said, well, my mother said, you're Chinese. And she couldn't see what was wrong with being Chinese. And told you, I couldn't see. And that was my first bad experience of prejudice. And as you can tell, I'm still bothers me. Yeah. So it shows you how deep prejudice can be.
Today, Mary Ling, the farmer's daughter, is better known as Mary Ling Mohammed. She's the driving force behind Mary's Bread Basket, a popular bakery at the Halifax Farmer's Market. Her family, the Lings, worked hard to establish a laundry in New Glasgow, and later, the Imperial Cafe in Halifax. They were successful, despite struggles and the sad story of Mary's mother, as this exhibition reveals.
We have an immigration certificate, which was registered for a toy thing. She was the mother of Mary Ling. Very tragic, but not the only story. She was kidnapped when she was 9 years old from China, and some two ladies had lured her with candy, and so she wound up in Canada, in Vancouver in 1910. From 1910 to 1924, she was in Canada working as domestic help. And at the age of 16, she was married off as a chom when they enacted the Chinese Exclusion Act. Every Chinese person in Canada had to be registered. So these are photographs like her children, her husband in the studio.
As we move through this exhibit, there are more pictures to view and a display case showing off a fancy pipe made of porcelain. It belonged to Hal Ling, Mary's father, an unusual-looking foreign object that prompted several visits to the Ling farm by police who thought it was being used to smoke opium. If there are parallels in many of these stories, the common thread is tolerance. Albert Lee recalls Chuck Lee.
When he's going through grade school, kids would invite him back to their homes, and the parents would come out and hear him. That whole sort of thing. He was the first Chinese kid in home.
How did he raise you? You have two brothers and a sister.
It wasn't any more different in a lot of ways. We get picked on, but insofar as, like, he also threw us nerve of fight back. And all the other repercussions that we generate negative feelings if he did fight back. So we just usually took things in stride. But, of course, school kids being school kids, sometimes people would just push up against the wall.
For most whites, contact with Chinese families revolved exclusively around the local Chinese restaurant or lunch counter. At first, Maritimers were slow to embrace what seemed like exotic cuisine. So most cafes and lunch counters served mostly maritime fare, and they adopted English names such as the Mayfair, the Regent, and the Imperial. Eventually, Maritimers came around to Chinese cuisine, and during the post-war era, dozens of Chinese cafes sprang up. A 1952 Chinese directory for downtown Halifax lists 44. One of the best known was the Garden View. Belle Fong, his wife, and six children lived upstairs, a common practice for Chinese proprietors. For decades, Belle worked 12-hour days cooking downstairs.
The Garden View restaurant was first established on the Spring Garden Road in 1944. And I used to work there after school, whatever, right about 14, 15, 16. It was a family restaurant. My brother was, and my father, and probably two uncles. We were lined up day in, you know. Well, this was pretty well a daily format, line up inside along the fountain, the table, lunch counter. Line up around there, go abreast, and sometimes you can go further out there as well. The line up. It's like going to a Saturday night movie.
And for more than 40 years, Saturday nights were big takeout nights with the university crowd who loved the egg rolls at the Gag and Spew. Urban renewal and an internal family feud eventually knocked it down. But now can point proudly to the new Garden View across the harbor. Son Greg Fong and Trudy continue to operate the oldest family-run restaurant in Halifax. Val's daughter Diane is also in the hospitality business and remembers growing up above the Garden View.
Mom would go down and get our lunch and bring it upstairs to the flat. And so, well, we spent a lot of time in the restaurant. And I remember my grandmother always sitting downstairs and in the booth there, and she would welcome a lot of the customers, and she was more or less part of the furniture, and it was just a neat way to grow up because you saw a lot going on in the kitchen.
Contrary to popular belief, the Chinese restaurants are Chinese-owned restaurants, but they're not there. They serve mainly 90% of the time for its Canadian food. Toasted Western sandwiches and hot hamburger sandwiches. And I like to see, oyster stew or clam chowder, 25 cents. A hot dog, 5 cents. There's 1942 prices. The only Chinese food here is pork fu yang, 35 cents.
By the 1970s, chop suey and sweet and sour combinations, unknown in China, had become well-known staples of North American Chinese cuisine.
This photograph here, taken in 1946, was the first Chinese wedding here in Halifax. Mr. Dao Fong, who owned me the photograph of Tommy, told me about the fact that I guess he was like in his teens, 17 or 18. They brought in a cook from Toronto. It was the first time he had a real Chinese meal, banquet style there, where people just sat and ate for 2 days.
Like Chinese Canadians themselves, the food is a complicated mix of the old world and the new. It tries to accommodate the brand new neighbors without losing the traditional flavors that characterize a culture. For Chinese Maritimers like Mary Ling, this exhibit brings back bittersweet memories that include what happened to her mother.
You know, I mean, I don't think about it every day, but it's just that this shows a lot of our past, and really, there's a lot of things that happened that's sad, and to this day, I still don't know my mother's side.
completion of the CPR in one maritime city after another, small groups of Chinese men arrived in search of employment. Hand laundries were easy to establish in Canadian cities, and it was a service in high demand throughout the Maritimes. So, as early as the 1890s, Chinese hand laundries began to appear in Halifax and St. John. The number of laundries in the Maritimes cast the die for stereotyping all Chinese men as launderers, a notion that survived into the late 1950s. Ironically, the patriarchal society in China had long considered laundry to be women's work. Linda Lee Oland remembers the laundry as more than work, though. Ms. Oland, now a partner with the McGinnis Cooper Robertson Law Firm in Halifax, remembers this.
When we were little, home for my older sister May, my younger brother Ken, and me, was Charlie Wild Laundry. We lived above the laundry on Barrington Street at the corner with Kent, and our father worked there. There was no distinction between home and workplace at the laundry. We children were not kept away from the laundry areas. Rather, we had the run of the entire place. We slid down the banister from the living quarters to the laundry. We watched customers come through the front door to the counter in the front room. There, laundry ready for pickup was already wrapped in brown paper and tied with string. One of the men used a nib pen dipped in India ink to write a Chinese symbol right on an item dropped off for cleaning. And that symbol was used for everything for that customer. I remember us playing beneath the ironing tables in the front room, even while the men worked. These were wide wooden tables, padded with blankets. A sheet was tightly stretched over the top, and that sheet would have to be replaced every week or so. Ken would crawl underneath the tables and help to hammer in the tacks which held the sheet to the table frame. The electrical cords for the heavy irons were suspended overhead. Fred Lee's father, James Lee, worked at the first table, and my father at the second. To keep us out of the way, May and I were taught to tie the brown paper packages and to fold the simplest item, handkerchiefs. Customers saw only the front room and the room behind it, which could be closed off from the front one by sliding doors. That back room was a workroom, too, but the doors were closed when we ate our meals there. There was no separate kitchen, just two burners in the back room. There wasn't even an oven. The women did the cooking for all the people at the laundry on those burners, and everyone ate every meal together. In the early 50s, Chinese foodstuffs were hard to come by in Halifax. The people at the laundry made their own tofu and grew bean sprouts. They also arranged periodic shipments from Montreal. It was a big day when the wooden crates arrived. They would be pried apart, and everyone would check out the dried fish, noodles and vegetables, the jars of condiments, the little bags of rice flour, the sticks of brown sugar, and the tins, some square and deep, all the essentials for Chinese cooking. People worked hard. There were no regular days off. Everyone lived above the laundry. Up the stairs, our family of five filled one of the front rooms. Fred Lee's parents lived in another room, and all the unmarried men, including the older boys, slept in a third room. If an out-of-town visitor arrived, and there was no room anywhere else, he was welcome to sleep on top of one of the padded ironing tables. Charlie Wild Laundry was a little community. It followed Chinese customs and traditions and celebrated the Chinese festivals in accordance with the Chinese calendar. Everyone spoke Chinese. For May, Ken, and I, Chinese was our first language, our mother tongue. When we started school, none of us knew much English, and we had had little exposure to the world outside the laundry. What I remember about the laundry is the warmth and the bustle. Everything, work, food, room, news, was shared. For us children, it was a happy world. Not until much later did we come to realize how little money and security our family had those years. At the laundry, there were always people working or relaxing both downstairs and upstairs. The door would open and close for customers and for members of the Chinese community coming to visit. Ken, the youngest and more importantly, a son, would be picked up and passed around to be admired. It was common.
constant conversation in Chinese and activity in the laundry and up and down the stairs to home. Linda Lee Oland is a partner with the McGinnis Cooper Robertson Law Firm in Halifax. Larry Hsu is another prominent Chinese maritimer. He's a history professor at UNB in Fredericton and author of The Chinese. Professor Hsu has studied the waves of Chinese immigration to the region. Professor Hsu, hello.
Hi.
Chinese immigration to this part of Canada was different before the 1960s. Now, what are the differences between the old wave of Chinese immigrants and then the new wave of immigrants to the Maritimes?
First of all, the old immigrants all came from a relatively small area in Guangdong province in China. They belong to one or a few particular dialect districts, and they formed fairly close kinship organizations, and most of them were poorly educated or had no education, and they acquired no particular skills, so they were unskilled laborers. The new situation is entirely different because we find greater diversity in terms of the geographic linguistic background. And secondly, the new immigrants turn out to be much better educated on average, and they acquired special skills or training, and also some of them came with considerable financial assets. So the situation is entirely different from the late 19th century situation.
When did you see that start to change?
It started from the 1960s.
So from that point on?
In fact, I came to Fredericton in the late 1960s. And when I first came, I still noticed a couple of Chinese hand laundries in existence in the city. But in the next few years, they simply disappeared. And I think the general liberal trend of Canada's immigration policy in the 1960s really made a difference. And it opened the door for many Chinese to be able to bring their families over and for new Chinese immigrants not to seek immigration to Canada. And that made all the difference.
In British Columbia, a lot of Chinese Canadians are very prominent, and they're prominent in government, they're prominent in business. Quite a bit of investment that goes with that. When do you think we'll see the same sort of presence here?
I'm afraid this is probably not going to come. I think that basically you have a numbers game. There you have such a large number of recent Chinese immigrants, and the majority of them came from Hong Kong, and they came with considerable asset, economic experience or professional experience. And with such a large concentration of the Chinese population, it is also easier for them to start to develop businesses. But in this part, I think the small number makes it difficult to not to do so. And the Chinese population in the Maritimes tended to be more in the professions. I think there are quite a few research scientists, professors, engineers in this area. And the ones in businesses are still mainly in the restaurant business area.
With all the changes, do you worry about assimilation? Is that a concern for your community, especially because it is still so small?
Yes, the interesting thing is that you mentioned that actually the Chinese in the Maritimes, I think, have a greater tendency to be assimilated when it comes to the next generation. In fact, in my own experience, I've seen my own children, among the children of my friends, many of them married other Canadians, white Canadians. So this is a general trend. I think one of the reasons is also because our own community is so small, and it's difficult for young people to find appropriate a person to form families. And the situation may be a bit different in Toronto or Vancouver areas.
The Chinese are now the fastest growing immigrant group in the country. What's the impact, you think, on the Maritimes?
I think there are quite a few Chinese in the professions, and they have certainly made their contribution in scientific research, in university teaching and in medical professions, I think the number of Chinese professionals are out of proportion to the total number of Chinese in this region. And secondly, there are a few recent Chinese immigrants who brought a fair asset with them, and some of them established newer style businesses, even the restaurant, for instance. Some newly opened restaurants in Halifax and other places are quite sizable operations. They are modern enterprise. They're no longer the kind of family cafe that the Chinese used to run before. So I would say the recent Chinese immigrants are making economic contribution to this region as well. Certainly culturally, I think many Chinese have formed cultural associations, and they try to introduce to the larger community of the Chinese cultural heritage, and at the same time promote multiculturalism, better understanding between the majority community and the Chinese Canadians in this region.
Well, Professor, thanks very much for the contribution that you've made today.